Good morning. My name is Kate Bushman, and I represent Stephen H. Goldblatt, appointed amicus curiae in support of Ms. Singh. May it please the court. The last time this case was before this court, Judge Williams authored an opinion that identified the appropriate comparison group, the average person in the general population, and the correct major life activity, learning, not test-taking, and remanded for further fact-finding because the district court's opinion was unclear as to whether he found Ms. Singh was impaired, intermixed the legal standards for impairment and substantial limitation, and mischaracterized the testimony of GW's expert witness. On remand, the district court made no further factual findings.
Well, the district court said he was going to clarify some things he had written, but he wasn't changing his opinion.
That's correct, Your Honor. But he did, in fact, restate his factual findings verbatim and did not make any further ones. And, in fact, the opinion did point out that part of the problem and why the court couldn't just affirm the judgment last time was the fact that he had intermixed factual and legal findings, and that the factual findings just weren't sufficient to support the legal conclusions that he was drawing.
So you want us to send it back?
Yes, Your Honor. We would like a remand. We think that the...
With what instructions?
Well,
we send it back once.
This is true, Your Honor. You did send it back once. The instructions that we would request are for the court to engage in the fact finding that the last opinion ordered, and for the court to properly weigh the evidence that was presented.
When you speak of fact finding, what do you mean?
I'm referring to the fact finding that was ordered regarding impairment.
Yeah, but what do you conceive of fact finding to consist of? There are parts of your brief which suggest that the failure to conduct new hearings was an error.
New hearings. I don't necessarily know that new hearings introducing evidence were necessary, okay. The court altered two major standards that were applied in the district court's opinion last time, and certainly some briefing perhaps from the parties that would allow the court to identify pertinent facts that would allow the court to draw legal conclusions and have an opinion that would be appropriate for appellate review and
The district court had made previous fact findings. Now we told him what the correct law is, and he made the same fact findings. But that you have to tell us why the fact findings aren't appropriate. It's possible that you can make the same fact finding under the new instruction, isn't it? What fact finding is not appropriate? If anything, we gave an instruction that was easier for the defendant with respect to who you had to make the comparison to, right?
Yes, Your
Honor. So if it could make a fact finding in the favor of the defendant with a stricter standard, it could certainly make the same fact finding with respect to the tougher standard.
Yes, Your Honor.
To the more lenient standard.
Yes, Your Honor. And as the court said in its last opinion, I guess what's crucial here is that part of this is that the court struck out all reliance on GW's expert, Dr. Ostrander. And it was noted by this court that was a lot of reliance was placed on his testimony, and very little reliance was placed on Ms. Singh's testimony. As far as sending it back, and what's missing is when the district court struck out that reliance, essentially, in its last opinion, the district court had attributed a sort of causal relationship that to Dr. Ostrander's testimony that was incorrect, that she had gotten into a more challenging competitive academic arena, and that's why she was failing. And that wasn't actually what Dr. Ostrander said, and so the court just struck out essentially its causal finding there. And then all that was left in this opinion was his repeated references to her academic success. Now, that's...
That isn't all that was left. That isn't all that was left. Well, the other thing that was left was the series of perhaps clauses, and it seems to me a fair reading of them, of the opinion as a whole, is that the suppositions referred to in the perhaps clauses were in fact the explanation for the limitation rather than the impairment.
Well, Your Honor, I think your phrase, a fair reading of the opinion, is telling, because a fair reading of the opinion would also be that he found her academic performance preclusive of a finding of substantial limitation.
I don't know. Where do you see language suggesting that?
Well, I'm basing this conclusion on his statement that he could not find that she was substantially limited, or that conclusion was compelled by the academic success she's enjoyed throughout her life, and that her own experience is replete with academic success.
Then there's no point in going on to what I've called the perhaps clauses, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I question whether your alternative reading would be a fair one.
Well, Your Honor, the perhaps clauses certainly aren't any aren't findings in any way. I mean, the perhaps clauses are just that. He's sort of saying, well, perhaps this is, perhaps that. He doesn't say, it's an attribute.
Well, she had the burden, right?
I'm sorry.
She had the burden of persuasion.
She certainly did, Your Honor.
Right.
But,
So he doesn't have to find that the propositions and the perhaps clauses were, in fact, the cause. He has to find that she's failed to show that the impairment was the cause.
Well, even accepting that that's the fair reading, or that's even the reading this court should attribute to his decision, that's certainly not the way that it's borne out in the opinion is certainly incorrect as a matter of law. Essentially, it looks like he built it up that she was just going to be unable to meet her burden of proof because of her past academic success. The discussion of her actual impairment is pretty much nil, because he doesn't even identify what her impairment is.
Well, he pretty much assumes that there's an impairment, but concludes that even if there is a impairment, it's not a significant limitation on learning, and it doesn't necessarily cause the limitation, right? It's not required that he make a decision about impairment if the other elements aren't met, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. But again, if we're reading this and we're giving it a fair reading, and we're looking at her attempt to meet her burden of proof, her theory of the case, which is never reckoned with in his opinion, is that she avoided activities previously and was able to achieve success in that way, by avoiding activities in which she was limited. And you're correct, Your Honor, if she failed in some other prong, he doesn't have to, you know, render a finding elsewhere. But the fact that he didn't make a finding as to what her impairment is,
he says, he does refer to it. He doesn't refer to it in medical terms, but that she has this reading impairment.
Exactly. Well,
And why, what is wrong with our reading the district court's opinion to say, in effect, I will take it as given that she has this reading impairment. The problem is there's all this other evidence as to problems that entered into her ability to succeed on multiple choice test taking, he says. And she hasn't eliminated those causes, and therefore she hasn't shown that this impairment is a disability under the statute.
I would dispute the fact that she has to eliminate all other causes.
What does she have to persuade the judge? She has to persuade him that this impairment is the cause, or at least the predominant cause.
By preponderance of the evidence.
Yeah.
And essentially, from his opinion, it looks like she approached this case, or the way he approached this case, she faced a stacked deck. Her academic performance in the past was something that she had to combat. Because, as he said, she appears quite able to succeed in the major life activity
of learning. But Judge Rogers is asking about, the district court actually has two grounds. One is whether it's a significant limitation, and the other is whether whatever impairment she has actually caused the problem. And she has the burden of proving that it is what caused the problem, correct?
Correct.
And he points out, the district court points out, that, well, there are other reasons why she failed out of medical school. She didn't pay attention to detail. She took too many extracurricular activities after being warned over and over not to. She studied by listening to music and singing while she was listening to the music after being warned not to do those things. And the district court concluded, among other things, that as a result, she can't prove that failing the test was due to her impairment rather than to her poor study habits. And while it's true that she has to prove by a preponderance, that's not our job. Our job is only to see whether the district court clearly erred in concluding that she had failed to prove by a preponderance. I'm right about that standard, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean,
well, be careful about how you.
I'm trying to be careful. I want to.
Is that a finding or a conclusion of law?
Exactly. I feel like it's a mixed finding of fact and conclusion of law. And
causation is a finding, is a law question, not a fact question.
Well, there's cause and fact, and there's the legal cause.
Well, I'm talking about the cause and fact question. Tell me how this gets to be a law question. The judge assumes that she's impaired, but finds, based on the fact that she has very bad study habits, that it wasn't the impairment, that there was not sufficient evidence to establish by a preponderance that it was the impairment rather than the study habits that caused her failing. Why is that a law question?
Well, I think it's the sufficient evidence part of that statement, Your Honor. That there is a legal standard entering in there, the sufficient evidence.
There's a preponderance of the evidence standard, but that's true of every single fact question we review. And we don't review that question. We only ask the question whether the district court clearly erred in concluding that there wasn't a preponderance of the evidence. Tell me why that's the wrong. Quite important to the result here. So explain why that's not the right standard of review.
It definitely is.
Right ahead. It's your podium.
I just wanted to see if I could couch what you're saying in terms of the district court's actual what the district court actually said. I think that's why I'm having trouble conceptualizing this.
In other words, what we're dealing with is, if I had been the district court, I might have written the opinion differently. If you'd been the district court, you might have written it differently. But the question is, what's the legal error here that would cause us either to reverse or remand?
Well, Your Honor, and I apologize if I was confusing when I answered your question earlier, because you had asked about causation clearly. I think the same problem pervades in both the causation finding and in the substantial limitation finding. If you read the opinion, his repeated references to her academic success in the past, it reads as if that prevents a causal nexus, that he cannot find a causal nexus because she has done so well in the past. There's just no way that that's what's causing it, because she's done so well in the past. She's been so successful. And that's why he doesn't make any findings. He rests everything on a string of perhapses, because in his mind, or at least in a fair reading of the opinion, he is saying that that she's able to succeed in the major life activity of learning. She got into grad school. She's fine. We don't need to give her any ADA help.
You weren't saying, are you, that her success in previous phases of education is irrelevant?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So it was pertinent for him to note that, to review it.
It is. It's pertinent for him to note. She's had tremendous academic success. That's how she got into this great program at GW. But then he needs to reckon with her theory of the case, which is that, well, yes, I did have this substantial academic success, but this is how I did it. And just as in Bartlett, she avoided these activities. She didn't know that she was, you know, impaired, I guess, in the clinical sense. And I think for a lot of high-functioning people, it's either hard for them to accept or they don't understand that that could possibly, you know, be the case if they're learning disabled. But she did not seek accommodation. She did not...
In turn, this might lead to her choice of study habits, which were unpromising.
Oh, Your Honor, if I could turn to the study habits just briefly. She was not repeatedly warned before she was diagnosed, and there are no sort of repeated warnings here.
I thought she went to the counseling center.
And this was after she had been doing very poorly in school. So it's
before the fourth time she's at risk.
Yes, it's shortly before that. But there's the one other part about this is there's no evidence that she, and in fact there's evidence to the contrary, that she had a robust extracurricular life in high school and in college, and that if you look at that as sort of a control factor, that, you know, what changed between...
Maybe medical school is harder than college and high school. Lots of kids have extensive extracurricular activities in high school, and fewer when they get to college, and fewer when they get to medical school. And the reason is it's too hard to keep up if you have the same set of extracurriculars all the way through.
Well, Your Honor, that's definitely a possibility, but that wasn't a finding that was made here. And again, the causal nexus here is broken. If any reading of this opinion, the causal nexus is broken by the fact that it's just plain as day, the substantial limitation question or the causal nexus, that her past academic achievement just stacks the deck. And if this is where we're going, that...
Stack the deck. I mean, if that's transformed into a reading of the opinion which says there's a rule of law that prior academic success bars flat out a claim of impairment and limitation in graduate school, you're almost certainly right. But I think it's hard reading the opinion as a whole to get that out of it.
Well, Your Honor, even if it's not looked at as a complete bar, even if it's just looked at as he says, compelling, and if she had the ADA-defined impairment she claims, her achievement should have been more consistently impaired. If it's just looked at as something that he just cannot reconcile.
Why isn't that every place where he says that, that's on the other argument. That's on whether it's a significant limitation. In the argument about the causal nexus, which Judge Williams was focusing on with the word perhaps, there's that language about compelled is not there at all. He says there are many reasons aside from plaintiff's impairment that might explain why the plaintiff has done relatively poorly. Perhaps she feels undue pressure. Perhaps she finds it unable to pay attention to detail. Perhaps her involvement in extracurricular activities prevented her from indicating the right amount of time and energy. Perhaps she doesn't study well. She even testified that she learned to get partial credit for books she had not read by simply repeating things. Perhaps those skills work for her on other testing formats. To the extent she's demonstrated any pattern of her performance as compared to other testing formats, any number of these or other factors may explain. And then she says he answers the question that you and Judge Williams were discussing. While the preponderance standard does not require the plaintiff to rule out every possible explanation, she must demonstrate that her explanation is more likely than not true. As many other explanations remain plausible, this court is not persuaded that she's met her burden. And the question for us is, it seems like you're asking us to do what Judge Rogers was suggesting, that decide what we would do if we were the district court. And as Judge Rogers pointed out, that's not what we're supposed to do.
Your Honor, I first, if I could just dispute your segregation.
Please.
Of the statements out of that section. If you look back to the footnote that the district court, I apologize, I'm not going to know the number, but the footnote that the district court dropped about how it didn't need to decide what impairment she had because it didn't cause her, he didn't cause it anyway. It didn't cause
her substantial disablement. That's right, surely. If he's right on the causation, it's entirely in her favor to assume the impairment.
And that's interesting because she has two separate impairments. She has that came up in this trial. She has only claimed one, which is a learning impairment. We'll call it that. But the other one is depression. And if he had actually found, no, I think she's actually depressed, then looking back at her past substantial academic success might not be relevant at all. It might have entered into a completely different causal calculation because maybe she was excited and happy about life until 9/11 and then became
depressed. You mean
that
depression was her disability, you mean?
Yes.
But she didn't make that argument anywhere. It's too late in the...
Oh, no.
Whatever the second or third trial is to do that.
Oh, no, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting that she did. What I'm saying is the effect of him not making that finding, of him just saying, well, I don't know what impairment it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. It didn't substantially, whatever it is, it didn't substantially limit it. It's a little bit odd to just say, well, I don't know what caused any of this. I'm not going to think about it. I mean, the fact of the matter is he should have ruled and said, you know, is she or is she not impaired, and in what way? And then the calculus he entered into for the causation would be much clearer. We'd be having a much different conversation.
Why don't we hear from Appley, and we'll give you some time, all right? Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. In a Title III ADA case, a plaintiff's past academic history is not necessarily preclusive with respect to whether that individual, the plaintiff, has an ADA disability. However, and I believe we even heard a concession now, it is highly relevant. A plaintiff's past academic history is highly relevant to the
concession you got was that it was not irrelevant. It's not quite,
it's not irrelevant. And we would go on to say it is highly relevant, indeed, Your Honor. And in this case, Ms. Singh's academic history, her history of academic success, which she achieved without accommodations, supports the district court's judgment that she failed to prove that her alleged impairments caused any limitation that she might have. Now, why is academic history relevant? It's relevant because Ms. Singh doesn't claim that she has an impairment that sprung out of nowhere when she entered medical school. Instead, she says that she has a hardwiring issue, a neurological impairment that's been with her through her life. And if that impairment or those impairments are substantially limiting, you would expect that it would play out, those impairments would play out in her life.
She argues that her principal way of guiding around it before medical school was by avoiding timed multiple choice tests, and apparently it was harder to do that in medical school.
She does argue that, sir. However, it is not probative. It does not diminish from the force of Judge Lamberth's conclusion. Why is that? It doesn't diminish from the force because taking timed multiple choice tests is not a major life activity. It may be a component of a major life activity, but it's not in and of itself a major life activity. And if she's avoiding doing something that is not a major life activity, it's not probative of the issue of accommodation or whether she's substantially limited. That's number one. But number two,
It surely is related to the life activity of learning.
This court acknowledged in its last opinion that taking time multiple choice tests may be a component of learning. However, but let's look at how she did perform on those time multiple choice tests that she took prior to medical school. The SAT is a great example. On the SAT, she scored at or above the average level. At or above the average level. She took Regents tests in all of her New York courses. She scored in those Regents tests, New York Regents tests, into the 90% range. She took an entrance examination for chemistry when she went into NYU Medical School. On that examination, which was partially multiple choice, she was able to do well enough in order to get into the elite program, the gifted program of chemistry at NYU Law School. So she did well. When she took time multiple choice tests, she generally did well before medical school. So that undermines any contention that she has a limitation, pardon me, she has an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity, because there is no consistent impairment. There is no consistent limitation, rather. That goes to Judge Lambert's opinion. Judge Lambert concluded, after looking at her prior performance, prior academic performance, after looking at all of the other issues that might explain, all of the other factors, that is, that might explain her weak performance in some courses, at least in medical school, concluded that she had failed, that Ms. Singh had failed to carry her burden of proof, had failed to establish that whatever impairment she might have causes the limitation that she's identified. That, Your Honor, is fundamentally a question of fact. It is quintessentially a question of fact that is deserving of this court's...
I understood the plaintiff's position here to be in parallel to what we did in the earlier opinion, that is to say that, of course, the district judge's fact findings are reviewed with great deference, but he has to be asking the right question, and the contention here is he was asking the wrong question, or framing the question erroneously.
If that is the plaintiff's, the appellant's contention, then she is mistaken. The district court, one fundamental element in establishing liability under the ADA is the question of causation. There has to be an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. Judge Lambert looked at all the factors, examined all of the evidence, including, but not limited to, Ms. Singh's prior performance, and concluded based upon that she had failed, Ms. Singh had failed to establish that causal connection. And that is what, as I said, the quintessentially question of fact that warrants this court's deferential conclusion, rather examination. We heard at the outset of the...
So that's your explanation of the district's introductory paragraph and final paragraph, where he states her prior academic success compels the conclusion. Because this is in the nature of, in your terms, a hardwired impairment.
Yes, Your Honor. It's his way of saying, for that reason, I conclude that. It is his way of summarizing the facts and reaching his conclusion. It is not to say that her history precluded, as a matter of law, a conclusion that she is not disabled as a matter of law.
So when you point to the MSAT, the Regents test, et cetera, it would be her burden to show that, in fact, her scores were not as high as they should have been because of this impairment? In other words, Dr. Newman talked about, you know, the difference between her verbal scores and her math scores, things like that.
Yes.
I'm just trying to understand. I mean, she passed, and who knows what the test was like that got her into the honors chemistry program, the Regents program. Do you see what I'm getting at? In other words, you say, well, there are these tests, and they have some multiple choice on them, and that's what she claims is the problem in medical school, at least as to some of the courses. Well, she succeeded elsewhere, so what's the problem here? But that assumes that the success elsewhere did not face these same hurdles for her.
You're right. That is an assumption that we're making. That's implicit in my argument. However, she claims that her problem is with taking timed multiple choice tests. And she has not explained away. She's offered no evidence, none at all, to explain how, if she has this hardwiring problem that we've discussed, how, if she has these neurological impairments that purportedly substantially limit the activity of, it's not a major life activity, but we'll call it the activity of taking time multiple choice tests, how is it that she was able to do so well on these other measures, such as the SAT, such as New York Reason, such as the chemistry examination that included at least partially a part of a multiple choice test? At the outset of the prior argument, we heard a complaint that the judge had failed to do what this court had instructed it to do. The court's instruction is contained on the last page of this court's opinion. And it's pretty clear that the court instructed the district court to determine whether Ms. Singh is disabled under the legal standards of the D.C. Circuit prescribed. And that's precisely what it did. There was no requirement that the court conduct another hearing. There was no requirement that the court below conduct receive new briefs or anything along those lines. All the court was directed to do was to determine whether Ms. Singh is disabled under the legal standards that the D.C. Circuit prescribed. It clarified some confusion that this court identified with respect to the Judge Lambert's use of the terms impairment and limitation. It removed any concern that the court had with respect to Judge Lambert's misinterpretation of Dr. Ostrander by not relying on Dr. Ostrander any longer. And it made clear that that Judge Lambert was assuming, for the purposes of his opinion, that Ms. Singh has an impairment. The court did all that it was asked to do. It issued a new opinion, clarifying every issue. That was all that it was asked to do. There is absolutely no need to remand. Now, this court has concluded, rather has observed, that the ADA is designed to enable disabled individuals to participate in the mainstream of society. Ms. Singh has indeed participated in the mainstream of society. Indeed, she's done so, when it comes to learning, she's done so at an elite level. Overall, she's done well. She's learned well inside and outside of law school, beginning from her earliest years when she learned how to read.
Law school?
Did I say law school?
Yeah, I think
I apologize. Inside and outside of school, both in academics and beyond academics, beginning from her earliest years when she was even 3 years old learning how to read. She didn't flourish in medical school. That's a given. She didn't flourish in medical school, but not flourishing in medical school does not establish that she is substantially limited in her ability to learn. Substantial evidence supports the district court's conclusion that Ms. Singh has failed to prove that whatever impairment she has.
Substantial evidence is also not the standard, is it?
Pardon me, sir?
Although we like the substantial evidence test because we are going to hear it in the next case or the case after that every single day.
I'm sure.
But here the test is clearly erroneous, not substantial evidence. Isn't that right?
The court did not err. The court did not clearly err. When it made the conclusion, when it reached the conclusion that Ms. Singh had failed to prove that whatever impairment she has resulted in her alleged limitations. As I said at the outset, that is indeed a question of fact. It warrants this court's deferential review. The court should affirm the decision below and the judgment entered in GW's favor.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. Just first of all, back to where we left off. By not finding an impairment, that allowed the district court to duck the causation issue all of itself. He did not discuss her evidence of impairment this way. This way he did not discuss and say, look, you know, she has this disability, impairment that causes her to read.
See how easy it is to make the mistake that we think Judge Lambert made.
That's why you have great clerks to catch that, right? But the reason is that he would have to look at this and say, look, the evidence is that she's in the second and ninth percentile in the reading fluency, and she's dyslexic, and she can't bubble in answers correctly herself. She mixes up the letters, and just this is what she's presented. And her presentation is that, you know, she's avoided these tasks in the past. But now I find that these other myriad issues possibly could be, or I'm just not convinced. You know, she's got the substantial evidence or substantial academic achievement in the past. I'm just not convinced at this point. But that's just not anywhere in the opinion. And this case has been remanded once before to be corrected for further fact-finding, indeed, that just didn't happen. And the causation issue and the substantial limitation issue have not been resolved
focusing only on the causation issue and not on the substantial limitation issue. The district court says, in light of all the evidence, this court finds that there are many other factors that could have limited plaintiff's ability to perform well on tests, some of which were the result of plaintiff's own choices and study habits. That sounds like a finding. And then our job is to decide whether it's clearly erroneous. Why is that wrong?
Well, Your Honor, because nowhere in this opinion does he reckon with either her theory of the case or her evidence of impairment. And that's something that you would expect a reasoned opinion to just at least mention, you know.
Well, he does mention it. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but he says, while this court accepts that a reading disability could affect a plaintiff's ability to compete time-pressured multiple-choice exams, and then it goes on to talk about, you know, she hasn't met her burden of proof. I don't think your argument works here in the sense I understand if she had a hearing problem, and he's talking about prior academic success and failure of causation, the two don't fit together. But that clearly isn't the context in which the district court is speaking.
Well, Your Honor, I think that I think that whether you disagree or not, the opinion is not clear on at all about the legal conclusions. And as far as whether the argument works or would work for a hearing impaired person and not a learning impaired person, I would like to know what learning impaired person could get accommodations at GW in med school, and why it is that a hearing impaired person could
obviously help if the person in medical school had not made certain choices which reduced the probability of her succeeding.
Well, Your Honor, I think that everyone honestly would admit that they have some bad choices in their life, and I don't.
I hope so.
Perhaps you listen to music while you're writing your opinions,
much to my own daughter's dismay, that's not a statute that allows us to overcome that problem. Can I ask you? I have another question, which is, in a way, more basic and. Question, the implication behind the question is probably wrong, and it probably doesn't matter in this case, but I do want to see what if you can explain the answer to this. If the basic life activity we're talking about here is learning, why does it matter whether she can take a multiple choice test or not? If she can learn, I mean, it seems to me that the inability to take a multiple choice test limits you in the ability to do well in school, to get an A, but it doesn't limit you in the ability to learn. It's the test of what you've learned, but it's not the learning itself. I know that the assumption of our previous opinion in a lot of other cases is that the learning is the activity here. Can you explain to me the answer to that question is?
If I could just note, I think that there aren't very many major life activities that have been identified, right? And they're mostly very broad things. Right. I'm correct about that.
But for this one, we adopted learning. She chose learning as the one she wanted to press. Now we have learning as the activity. And all she's shown really is that she's a bad test taker, even accepting all, if that were correct. But people can learn and still not do well on tests.
Well, Your Honor, so in the broader context, it's just very broad definitions of things. So, for example, someone who's diabetic would say, I'm substantially limited in the major life activity of eating. It doesn't mean they can't put food in their mouth. It doesn't mean they can't chew or ingest or even absorb nutrients. Mm-hmm. It just means that their body can't regulate their blood sugar, and that if they don't eat at certain times or monitor certain things, they could go into diabetic coma. Mm-hmm. And so the imprecise language about major life activity actually, I guess it's troubling sort of on its face, but when you think about it in the context of, you know, what has happened, the fact that Congress really didn't sort of, you know, specify a lot of major life activities, I think that it makes a lot more sense. And then you look at it and you say, okay, learning, you're right. She's actually asking for, I would phrase it a little differently. She's asking for an accommodation to allow herself to demonstrate what she's learned.
Right. It's not the learning itself, it's the demonstration of the learning.
Exactly. But actually, it is also the learning, too, and that's something that she has pled and has raised this entire case, is it's the reading. It's not just that the output part of it is broken, it's also the, and I apologize, broken maybe is an extreme word. But it's not just the output has a problem. The input is highly flawed.
I see. So the reason that she has a problem with these tests is that she has an underlying reading problem, and that is a learning problem.
Yes. And
I mean, don't you have a difficulty? If heavy reliance has been put on that, there would have been a question whether any accommodation would have solved it.
I'm sorry. Are you questioning whether she relied on it below?
Well, if she put all her eggs in the reading basket, that problem would have been quite central, would it not?
Well, I think she put her eggs in both baskets. I mean, the multiple choice test taking is what's causing her to have to request the accommodation. She didn't request accommodations in the past, according.
So there was natural focus on the multiple choice test taking.
And she did mention the reading as well. And when it is imprecise, I mean, it feels like it should be more focused. But this is.
No, I think you've answered. I appreciate it.
If I could, I just wanted to make one last point. And this is about the hardwiring comments that have been made. And the fact of the matter is there is no sort of exception to the ADA for a disability that is hardwired, that she had to have raised this long time ago, she should have sought accommodations.
Yeah, I think that became relevant on the question of contrast with an impairment that had arisen after she had these successes in school.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that is absolutely consistent with what she has said this entire time during the case, which is that this is an impairment that she worked around, that she didn't even really understand that she had. And you know, some of us just assume we're bad at math. And so we don't take math courses, or maybe you just have an accountant, whatever. But, you know, she assumed that she was not doing very well in reading, and she avoided classes, sought exemptions for classes that had reading, and that was the way she worked around it. So the fact that this is a hardwired disability really doesn't change any of the analysis here. It's absolutely completely consonant with what she said, and the district court never reckons with it. And I think that is really something the court should think about. The fact that her theory of the case is not reckoned with in his opinion after it had been already remanded once for more. Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.